Hi, thanks for joining us on Hometown to Hollywood. This is Bonnie Wallace, author of The Hollywood Parents Guide. And today my guest on this podcast is Emmy-nominated screenwriter and producer Josanne McGibbon. Josanne has written many scripts for both film and television with her writing partner, Sarah Perriott, but she's best known for Runaway Bride, The Starter Wife, Desperate Housewives, Disney Descendants, and Descendants 2. Josanne, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Bonnie. Happy to be here.
So how did you get started as a screenwriter? Was it something you always knew you wanted to do?
I grew up in New York, and I wanted to be a playwright from a young age. And in fact, then my family moved to Los Angeles when I was a senior in high school, and I even majored in playwriting within the English department at UCLA. But when I got out of school, I sort of, very practically speaking, just thought, well, I'm in Los Angeles, theater's in New York, but movies and television are here in L.A., and I'm going to stay here in L.A., so now I'm going to set my sights on movie and television.
But you learned the craft from a playwriting standpoint.
Yes, and what was hard for me at first was, particularly since I was in movies for most of my career, for the early years, for more than half of my career, it's much more visual. And so what I had to learn rather quickly was not to rely on dialogue to tell the whole story.
Which is a very playwrighty sort of
right,
thing to do.
Right. And in fact, my talents, I would say, were almost better for half-hour TV comedy, which is more like a one-act play, but I didn't go into that. I went into features, so I was up and running, you know, with learning a visual vocabulary more.
That's so interesting. So what is the difference to you between, like, a script that one would write for a play versus a script that one would write for a movie?
Well, a play has many practical limitations because, of course, you're not going to have a train, a train chase or explosion. I mean, so a play usually has just a couple of sets, so three or four sets. You have only a certain number of cast members because you can't hire 80 people every night. And so you basically rely more on dialogue and smaller scenes to tell the story. There's more of an emphasis on character and dialogue, and less of an emphasis on visual still, storytelling. I mean, in movies, you have montages, you have editing, you have all these other tools of telling a story, which is not just the two people or five people talking, you know, at a great dinner party where everybody's humiliations are exposed or something. You know, but some stories are better told in theater and some stories are better told in film.
That's actually something that I came to believe very much when I was younger. I don't know. I think I was in college when that really dawned on me that some things are best expressed through, say, painting or poetry or music or theater. And I think it's really true. I mean, I think there are some stories that are truly best told through a certain, most effectively, powerfully told through a certain genre.
I mean, yeah, and one of the things that's so interesting about seeing adaptations of plays in movies is, you know, they call it opening it up, which means like, okay, now we can go and in Death of a Salesman, we can go see what happened in Boston. You know, we can go to Boston or something. But really, I think often the best adaptations don't mess around with it that much. I mean, I thought Fences was fantastic, and the adaptation was fantastic. It was still mostly the filmed play, you know, and if August Wilson, I think, had been writing a movie, he would not have written all those scenes happening in two places.
But it made it so much more powerful.
Yeah, fantastic, yeah.
I wonder, would you, for somebody, and I'm jumping way ahead now, but if somebody was thinking that they wanted to be a screenwriter, would you suggest that they study playwriting?
As long as it was folded in.
Folded into screenwriting.
Among other things, yes.
Because they're different.
They are different, but I would say yes. I would also say they should study English literature, and I would also say, you know, they should study plays, they should study films, not just screenwriting, but films.
Yeah, what is effective, what is not effective. So how do you write with your partner, Sarah Perriott?
Well, this ties in a funny way with what we were just talking about, because I was a playwright originally, and Sarah was an artist, and she went to RISD, which is Rhode Island School of Design, and she was a painter and a textile designer and was much more visual than I. And when we first started 32 years ago, you know, I was more apt to take the dialogue-heavy scenes, and she was more apt to take the visual scenes and descriptions. You know, that it was very hard for me to just describe action, and I don't mean action, just even movement.
Yeah.
So when we first started, we landed on something right away, which we always did and still do, which was we break the story together, which means we decide the plot and outline the movie together. And then we just start splitting up scenes. And I'll take the first one, she takes the second, I take the first two, she takes the second two, whatever. And then we're writing a part, but then rewriting each other and ourselves as we build it along. And so back in the early days, she would be more apt to take a scene that had more movement, and I would be apt to take a scene that was more static. And then it you know, within, I don't know, a year or so, our talents had just leveled out, and we had each, you know, were capable of doing the other one proficiently. So then it ends up being like, we'll have written a few scenes, and then, you know, if I had the choice last time of I took the fun, explosive dinner party scene, you know, then when we have two scenes coming up, she gets to pick which of the next two she wants first and so on. So we just build it like that. We write separately and rewrite as we go. And then at the end, we end up with a full draft. And then together, we make notes. Well, we make notes on the draft and do the changes together. So that's how we do it.
That's so cool. It's quite common to write in teams in Hollywood, yeah?
Yeah.
I think that's really interesting.
It's more common for TV than features.
Okay. Yeah, I know it's quite common in TV.
Yeah.
And you're right. When I think about the people that I know who are screenwriters, you know, who've done more film, like, that is less common.
Yeah.
That's so interesting.
And honestly, I don't know what other female teams there were when we were doing it in Hollywood for features. And that was sort of a unique branding for us. You know?
Yeah. More of that, please.
Yeah. Well, it was good. We came not long after Thelma and Louise, and it was like, it's practically like not, we were less like Cali Curry and more like Thelma and Louise, you know, there was the blonde and the brunette or something. And it's like, we walk in and there's Thelma and Louise and we got a lot of jobs, you know? So.
Well,
it was pretty good.
And you've produced some really amazing work. What do you think the differences between writing for TV and writing for film are? Because you've done both.
Have done both. And the biggest difference is that when you're writing a film, there's a beginning, middle, and end, and everybody has their arcs in that 1.5 or 2 hours. And by that I mean the characters change in a way that's important and exciting for an audience. But when you're writing a series, an ongoing series that you hope won't end for a long time, you need to keep the people really with their flaws and kind of reset. You might have little lessons every episode, but kind of have to reset them because you can't, as in the example of Descendants, when the kids, you know, start off as villain kids and end up choosing good over evil. Spoiler alert, but, you know, they
Everybody's
do.
Seen Descendants 1
right,
by now.
Right. You know, you can't do that. You can't do that. And then we did do episode 2. It's the next movie. But, I mean, you can't every week reset them and have them be bad kids.
Yeah.
And so if you want to keep the conflict of what's it like for bad kids to go to school with good kids, you can't get them there.
Yeah.
So you're basically coming up with stories that mine that conflict as opposed to resolve it.
That's
so interesting. That's one big one. Another one is you have much more time to tell a story. You know, we the first TV we did was a 6-hour miniseries, so it still had an end at the end of 6 hours, but we had so much more time to plumb each character. So for me, I loved it, coming from playwriting especially, that now it was much, you know, really time to develop every single character over the course of 6 hours. And that's the fun, too, of writing a longer series. You really are still, you have much more breathing room. A scene doesn't have to be, you know, propelling the plot in the same way that it can just be, it can expand and just, you can know a character better or have fun with something that isn't necessarily driving the story as much as it has to if it's a 2-hour story.
That's so interesting. It's like poetry versus short stories versus novels.
Yeah.
You know, and they all have their special things they can accomplish. Oh, my head. So what's your preference right now? What's more fun for you?
Well, there are practical things I like about writing for television better. And there are practical things I like writing movies better. So the practical reason I like TV better is that, particularly in series, the writer is the executive producer. You know, if you're the creator of the show, you're the showrunner. And that is what it sounds like. You are running the show. And in theatrical films, the director is running the show. Mm-hmm. Even if you wrote the script from your own idea and you've rewritten it over 5 years, the director's hired and he or she takes over. And you are then serving his or her vision instead of yours. And when you're running the show, directors come and go because you have a lot of them. And so happily for a writer, suddenly we're the ones whose vision is king.
Is and, consistent.
Yeah, yeah. And the directors are more considered the guests who come and go, and you are the one who is really getting the whole look of the film and hiring the designers and the casting director and the actors. And, you know, so I love that because I love having more. Well, it's fun to do so many things that aren't writing.
Yeah.
And it's fun to be the boss.
Yeah.
You know, but what, of course, I love about features is that you work at home, you know, and you can stop at 3 instead of 10 p.m. So
yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
And for me, there's not much difference between writing a movie for TV or writing a movie for feature. I mean, it's more the series versus the one-off. So, yeah. But TV, people sure see your stuff on TV, especially if it's the Disney Channel and they're marketing it.
Yeah, we got some cool news today.
Goodness.
I guess
did.
It was today, wasn't it? 5 different channels.
Yeah. Yeah, including ABC, which is pretty wild.
It's incredible. My head is still kind of exploding over
that.
Same
here.
It's terribly exciting.
Same here.
So this actually takes me perfectly into my next question, which is how involved are writers in the casting process?
And it's very, you know, I would say my entire time in features, zero.
Zero in okay.
In features. No, that's not true. There was a movie that it was Sarah's and my first spec, and it was the only movie that we ended up with producer credit. And because we were producers on it, because it was a spec, so we had more control, we were involved with casting. And by the way, would you like to know the unknown who walked in, whom our director and we cast? Brad Pitt.
Get out!
Yeah, Brad Pitt. And it was before Thelma and Louise had come out, so no one knew who he was. And he was just coming in like everybody else with a bunch of people we all knew better. And he made it. And he was good.
Which movie was that?
It was called The Favor.
Wow.
It was called The Favor. No one ever... It's and even Brad Pitt never talks about it in any of his interviews because it just came and went and it was a comedy and that was not where he landed with his career. But
well, paid his rent until he could, I suppose.
It absolutely did. It absolutely did. But so that's unusual though. Typically you're just, you know, reading about it in People magazine who got into your movie.
Who got into my movie
yeah.
that I wrote
yeah.
out of my brain.
Pretty much. But with TV, we're completely involved, yeah.
Well, so what about a TV movie like Descendants?
With Descendants, they were very kind, and we were not in the room, but we were sent all, in the first one, we were sent all of the audition tapes. And actually, so many auditions were in Canada that everyone was being sent the audition tapes, because that was where, you know, we had our core cast hired in L.A., and the rest was hired in Canada. So... anyway, so we got to see all that and weigh in. It was fun because, in a way, it's more fun to watch the audition tapes at home. You can, like, I'm always concerned, especially since I write comedies, that I want to give all the auditioning actors some you know, sugar.
Yeah.
You know, because it's so hard for them. They're by themselves. They're reading with a casting person who isn't the same as an actor. And, you know, and so... I'm always concerned about laughing or encouraging them or smiling or looking alive. And it's frankly very easy to be sitting in my office at home and just really analyzing what they're doing, watching it a second time. And I like that, but it's fun to meet the actors too, but it's very efficient to be home and just do it, watching it that way too.
So were you part of the, casting process when it got down into the final choices, or
well, they invited our input. They, yeah. you know, yeah. I don't think, honestly, there was never any close call. I mean, you know, there was always, there was an easy consensus. There was often an easy consensus. I would say that if anything, our voices meant more at the beginning when we would see 16 people and the emails would be flying about everybody's favorites, and suddenly perhaps Sarah or I would say, I actually like this person over here, and then everyone would go and look at that and take mm-hmm. it more seriously again. But when we were down to the last few, we always said our favorite, and it typically is the same person everybody liked.
But that's good.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
That's what you would want.
Absolutely. And you know what? Especially with Kenny, you know, I mean, because he's cast a lot more than I have. And I also trust him, especially with kids, to know, to be able to see what he's going to be able to get and all that. So I don't worry if my favorite isn't picked, because I kind of trust him. And I trust Disney, frankly, you know, that they kind of know what their brand is, and someone who has a certain quality may fit. And I bow to that, but it's fun to have input.
Oh, I would think so. I love watching auditions. I'm a total geek that
way. No, it's totally fun.
It's super fun. Well, while we're talking about Descendants, what are some of your favorite things about the first and the second movie?
I would say it's, you know, Sarah and I did not write for children our whole career until then. And what I love about Descendants is that we wrote something that I really believe in both cases are meaningful and influential to an audience that can be affected by that. And you always hope that people can be affected by art, and I'll call it art, you know, telling stories and making them up and showing them to people. But I don't really think that Runaway Bride changed a lot of lives, but I think Descendants does. And I actually think both of them, you know, have very powerful messages that I haven't seen in a lot of places. And I'm proudest and happiest with that. And, you know, they both came out beautifully and told our story with heart and humor and amazing production value. You know, and then the Disney machine gets them seen. So that's what I'm proudest. That's what I'm most excited by, is that, you know, and that there are really important messages in, you know, several different ones in both movies that I think can speak to a kid who may be going through something and help them.
I agree. And I think there's something very beautiful about being able to have the opportunity to reach that many people with something that's powerful and filled with heart. And I know that there's a certain brand of artist who feels that anything commercial is inherently suspect, let's say, at best. And I used to be one of those people, starting in poetry.
Right. That makes sense.
Makes sense. You know, poetry is not, you know, ever going to, at least in this century, in this culture, appeal to the masses. But what's the good? If you create something beautiful and moving and important and life-altering, if a dozen people are reached, you know, why not reach more people if it's that powerful and you know, moving?
Yeah.
If it can change lives. And that is something that nobody does, like the Disney Channel.
It's true. It's true. And you know, for all of their commercial, I mean, it's an empire. And they know what they're doing, and they want to make money, but they do want to do it with good values. Mm-hmm. They do care about the values, and I've enjoyed that they care about what they're saying in the material.
Yeah, well, and in the case of this franchise, I've just seen up close so much how it really has landed and reached so many people. And that's exciting.
It is exciting.
You know, and to feel like your words and your ideas and your, I don't know, vision, I guess, gets to...
Well, and even at the easiest, most, you know, superficial level, girl power, you know, and that's without even going down into really what they're all going through. But we have, you know, the strongest part is a girl, and she's the leader of her gang, not... coincidentally played by your daughter.
But, which is pretty fun.
Which is pretty awesome. You know, I mean, so just, you know, I've had so many people, you know, saying to me that their kids are dressing as Mal for Halloween, you know, and that they're powerful little girls who are mm-hmm. identifying with a superhero, essentially, mm-hmm. you know, so that's pretty fun.
Mal is basically a superhero, I think, in a lot of, she's sort of an anti-hero superhero.
Yeah.
But, yeah, who wouldn't want to be Mal? I would want to be Mal, for sure. I know Dove wanted to be Mal the minute she read that script. What are some of the more challenging things about writing for film and TV, and what are some of the best things about writing for
film
and TV?
Well, the difference between writing for film and TV and writing poetry is everybody gets an opinion.
Yeah.
And you are paid, you know, I mean, so, and even if it's your original movie, once a studio writes you a check, it's theirs. They own it. All the rights, I do not, you know, and now if you're not lucky, no one ever tells you to do anything and it doesn't get made, you know, I mean, so if the goal is to have it made, you will have so many cooks in that kitchen that the challenge is being collaborative, taking ideas, whether you agree with them or not, and figuring out a way to service the script that you love by making these people happy, maybe a strong word, but by satisfying their needs or desires, and you know, which can seem very arbitrary or sometimes wrong, mm-hmm. you know. So, you know, but Sarah and I have never just said, "Oh well, we'll just do it their way, no matter what." You know, like we always, always, always find a way to solve a problem that someone's having, you know, in a way that we like. You know, and often what that takes is, when someone is giving you notes that you say, don't tell me what the solution is, tell me what the problem is, and let us see if we can come up with a solution that satisfies us both. But that collaboration and creative, you know, dilution is the biggest challenge, I would say. You know, and the heartbreak of so many things going south because they just can't get the director and the actors all at the same time before the executive moves on to the next thing he or she is prioritizing. So that's the business part.
That's a highly collaborative art.
It is. Yeah. It is. And, you know, and the point is that the art form isn't a screenplay, it's a movie. I can write a screenplay and be very happy with my screenplay, but that's not the end. That's mm-hmm. like you writing your idea for a poem down and, you know, it's like, well, that's as good as a poem. It's not a poem, but it's a good idea, you know. So that's the biggest challenge of writing TV and movie.
Yeah, no, yeah. And the logistics of that are just, they're just crazy. I mean, just to get the cast all lined up, because all the actors, you know, that you may want, they've all got their other things going on, other irons in the fire, other commitments, other contracts, you know, obligations, and then of course the director and of course the executives, and getting it all lined up really is a puzzle. And you know, sometimes an actor would love to do something, but they can't because of another obligation, and then somebody else gets it.
And absolutely. And you know, and that happened with Runaway Bride. It took 10 years for it to line up. And every meeting we had for those 10 years started with, what's happening with Runaway Bride? I love that script. Why isn't that made? Well, we had Harrison Ford and Gina Davis, but we didn't have a director. By the time we got a director, we lost Harrison Ford. Then we got someone to be with Gina Davis, then we lost that director. I mean, it just kept on flip-flopping, you know, for 10 years until suddenly, you know, we had the wonderful man, woman, and director.
So this is audio, so you all can't see, but my mouth has just been open for the last 30 seconds. 10 years?
Yeah.
10 years.
But the great thing is, like, usually, you know, everyone would have lost interest and picked up their toys and gone home by then. The fact was we had a production company that never gave up on it. And that was Interscope Pictures, and they never gave up. And it was kind of fantastic, you know, and then sure enough, they got it done.
And sure enough, it was a huge hit.
It was a huge hit.
Was that your first big?
It was absolutely our first big hit. We had done Three Men and a Little Lady, but that was, you know, a sequel but Runaway Bride was all ours, and it was just exploded out of the gate. I think it was the most successful romantic comedy, you know, when it came out.
In years.
Yeah.
Before or after. Well, let's go back a little bit. So you go to school, you you know, study playwriting. Yes. You graduate, you decide, okay, I'm in LA. We're going
right.
to shift. We're going to pivot a little bit.
Right.
Which probably a very smart choice.
Right.
You meet up with Sarah and you start writing scripts. How did you get started? How'd you get your, like, foot in the door? What did you do?
Sarah had written two or three humor books and had an agent because I think she met a lawyer, some lawyer or somebody wanted to option one of the humor books or something like that and possibly have a movie written on it or something like that. So she got an agent and in fact wrote, I think she had written one movie with this agent, and also her brother was in the business and she had written something on one of his TV shows. But basically when we, you know, so it was very early, but she had the key piece was she had an agent.
That's
and
huge.
So it was. And so then when she and I decided to write together, we wrote a spec script, which was The Favor, which ultimately had Brad Pitt. And
your first spec script has Brad Pitt.
Yeah.
Sorry,
yeah.
I'm
well,
stumbling.
No, no.
It's amazing.
Well, it wasn't amazing because who was Brad Pitt? But it was amazing. The funny thing is our big get was Ken Wall. Do you remember Ken Wall?
No.
Exactly. Anyway, that was our big get. But anyway, we wrote this spec script and then immediately our agent was getting us meetings. And within a few months, we got our first paid job of adapting a book. And it was called Worth Winning. And within a year, that movie was being made. And then we also went out for a pilot, and within a year, that pilot was made. So suddenly we had, you know, we had tried two things and they were both made and we thought it was that easy.
Sure.
And we just said, what do we want to do? Do we want to do movies or television? And at that point we thought in success, I had children already, she did not. And in success, I would never see my children if I succeeded as a TV writer. And
right.
in those days, you didn't do both. It was one or the other. And so we had just done, we got lucky that we did both at the very beginning, you know, our first year of working together. But then it was a real conscious choice. And it was just, I wanted to be able to pick my kids up from school. So I just said, let's do features.
So was it sort of like not that long ago, if you were an actor, you were a TV actor.
Absolutely.
Or you were a film actor or you were a stage actor.
And it was the same with writing.
That's so interesting. I would not have thought that about writers.
And there was also, and there in the same way, there was a, you know, the feature writers were considered more fancy, you
oh,
know, than the
sure.
TV writers.
Yeah, yeah.
That has changed.
Completely.
Except now everybody's writing everything. Mm-hmm. But
And everybody's acting in everything.
Right.
That's cool. Okay, yeah. So you decided because of the lifestyle and you had kids and you wanted to have a life that you would move toward features.
Yes. And honestly, you know, I mean, that spec script continued to get us work, as did, you know, the fact that right away we had Worth Winning out and we were backing up jobs. It was crazy. I mean, honestly.
And you had little kids.
Yeah.
How did that work?
It was like a dream. I mean, I was taking them to the dentist and I could go on a field trip with their classes, you know, and just not work those 2 hours of that day. I mean, so I that was just a dream.
All right, everybody out there, all you working parents. No, seriously though, like I've been self-employed my whole life too, and for parenting, it was the best.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and as a matter of fact, we kept saying, you know, and our agent and we at one point got a manager too, and they were saying TV, and was saying, no, kids. And finally we had this manager who said, Josie, your kids are in college and Sarah's are in high school. So I really think you could do this Starter Wife, which is a 6-hour miniseries. So there you'd be in and you'd be out and you don't ever have to do it again. But I really think this has a shot. And I thought, well, that is true. My kids aren't even living at home anymore. I suppose I could, you know. And it was just at the time that this crossover was happening and it wasn't considered like, oh, I don't want it to do television.
Yeah.
And then it was the most extraordinary experience we ever had.
Yeah,
it was fantastic. So,
that's a perfect segue. You were saying, you know, most of your projects have been aimed at adults.
Yeah.
And you've got a joke somewhere that references, you know, the fact that you've written Runaway Bride, Starter Wife, Desperate Housewives. There is a bit of a pattern.
And
there.
Descendants.
And Descendants.
I know. Isn't that funny? Like wife, mom, woman, child. I know.
It's really interesting.
Yeah.
Well,
I know.
Relationships, family. Was there much of a difference writing for the Disney Channel?
Well, we were a little wary, especially because our mind, and of course not that we had even watched the Disney Channel, but we were concerned that it was going to be, really, that we'd have to dumb it down.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
And what they said to us right at the beginning was, we want you for the way you write. Write your way and let us tell you when, we want to be able to appeal to all audiences, including the parents who are in the room with their children. So let us sort of pull you back and don't do it ahead of time. And so we did. And, and also having been moms, we knew what kids liked. And I think the thing that took us a couple drafts to find was the sweet spot of the humor, and that in part, even though we have some dry humor that I think is over the kids' head, but that sweet spot of silliness. So that sort of, when we found it, then we were able to aim better and make sure that it was funny for kids as well. But there was no sort of writing down in terms of the emotional stuff. No one was making us maybe a little having to say the obvious. Maybe there's some of that, and that was layered in like, okay, that's a little subtle. Let's say it harder, but not in a way that offended us really.
That's huge. Well, my favorite stuff that's aimed at kids is stuff that is so layered that when the adults are watching it with them, which is pretty inevitable, that there's a bunch of stuff there for them too.
Yeah.
And that's really the tone that you guys hit. I know a lot of adults love the movie.
Good.
And I do too.
Thank you.
Not just because my kids. It's just really good.
Yeah.
It's really good. And there's a lot of stuff there for you, regardless of whatever, level you are in terms of understanding and catching.
Well, that's our hope.
Yeah. No, yeah. It's there.
Well, by the way, sometimes we'd be using words that the channel would say, I don't think kids know that. And I always said, then this is how they'll learn it.
Yes.
That's how you learn what a metaphor is. They may not understand when we use the word, but they might learn it.
They'll learn it by hearing it in context. That's actually, truthfully, my kids were exposed to some really good film. We actually didn't have television. They didn't grow up with cable. There was no signal in our house, but we watched movies and we watched some really good movies, and their vocabulary was huge as a result.
Mm-hmm.
You learn stuff by hearing it. Nothing wrong with that. Any advice for writers, young writers who want to break into screenwriting for film and TV?
I guess, my first piece of advice is, how much a person should rewrite anything he or she has written, because I think often a mistake is if they are fortunate enough to have someone who can help them, that they rush something to that person's eyes. And you really kind of only get one shot with a person. I have had lots of people ask me to read something, and they're friends of friends or friends of my kids who went to school with somebody else. It can be really remote. And if I say yes, and if I'm not impressed, I'm never going to say yes to that person again.
Yeah.
I'm going to say good luck.
Yeah.
So the biggest thing I would say is don't be in a rush to what, how can I climb? Focus on, do it well. Unlike an actor, you can do it and redo it and redo it and redo it and show it to some people and get some input. So that's the first thing, is really try to have a good polished thing. Secondly, honestly, I'm a little bit at a loss because I think it's both harder and easier than it was for me 30 years ago. When I got an agent because Sarah had an agent, but Sarah had an agent, she didn't kill herself to get one either. She had written something that caught someone's eye. That can still happen. But in a way, and then our agent was just getting us work. So I don't think that's so easy. I think it's hard to get someone's attention and harder to get an agent, but there's so much more content than there was. There's, obviously with all of the TV streaming outlets and with YouTube, and you can, not everybody's a performer or a director, but if you write something, you can find a way to get it somehow on an iPhone and up on YouTube. And there are blogs, and I think there are a lot of people with blogs who are getting noticed, and or for heaven's sake, tweets. That if they have a voice that someone is out looking for, that they you know, that they really may be noticed or be able to be noticed. And then if they have something that they're ready to show when someone says, do you have anything? And you say, you bet I do. Here's a pilot. Here's an original feature. But I don't think there is the same kind of just A, B, C, D that was clear. I mean, when I started, the Writers Guild had a list of agencies and they had stars next to the ones that took unsolicited material. And you just could go down the list and say, all right, I'm starting with the alphabetically. And here's, I'm sending a script with a self envelope, you know, self stamped envelope. And someone might read it. And I don't think that happens anymore.
No, no. It is interesting. It's like, I think the creative life, I think life as a creative tends to not have much A, B, C, D, you know,
yeah.
if you just follow the
yeah.
breadcrumbs, you will arrive at your destination.
No.
You know,
right.
Anybody who wants to be a creative for a living doesn't have that luxury. But at the same time, as you say, there are many more paths, many mm-hmm. more, you know, trails of breadcrumbs to try and follow and see what you can put together for yourself.
And I do think with blogs and everything that people can develop a writing voice. And in a sense, for some public, even if the public is your family and friends, I mean, you know, at least you can write. And one of the things I love about writing is you can write alone. You do not have to, you know, you don't need money to write. You don't need an audience to write. You know, nobody can take that away from me.
You don't need a casting director to say yes to you to write. Yeah. There was something we were talking about before we were recording, and it was about shooting in different countries. Descendants was shot in Canada. So there's a certain number of actors who were required to be Canadian or UK citizens. Is that how that worked?
Yes.
So that affected casting.
Yes.
So that's a way for, and there's a lot of stuff that's shot out of the US. That's a way for a lot of actors who are not U.S. actors to, you know, get involved in amazing projects and build
yeah.
their resumes.
Yeah.
And you've shot things in Australia.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it was the same thing where, you know, in order to get the certain tax break, we had to have no more than a certain percentage of our actors be American. And for that matter, we could have almost no crew be American. They all had to be Australian. And
or
that's
Canadian.
Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that's true when we're in Canada. We've got Kenny, but he's not taking his AD, you know, mm-hmm. so it has to be a non-U.S. person who's doing all that. Absolutely. Now, I don't know all the avenues where Vancouver actors are. I guess you would know better than I, whether, you know, you make your relationships with the Canadian casting directors in the same way you would do here, and they would have representation, hopefully, who get them noticed. But, you know, yes, especially Vancouver and Toronto, probably mostly Vancouver, you know, that so many American productions are there, and the call goes out. We need them.
The call goes out, and their agents pick it up and mm-hmm. send them the tapes.
By the way, you know, one thing that was interesting in seeing the tapes of all the people coming in is several of them are self-taped where they're not even a casting. You know, now, again, I'm not sure how they, it may be because they're nowhere near the casting director and the casting director sends them the sides, I guess, or I don't know if it goes
to their
agent.
And tells them to self-tape, yeah.
And so tells them to self-tape. And we had a couple people in our current movie who self-taped.
I think Dylan Playfair was
I know
one
Dylan
of those, right?
Did.
He was telling me, because I had him on the podcast, that I think he was filming Letterkenny. And he got the call for Descendants 2.
Yeah.
And he made the self-tape, like, on his iPhone with his friend. And there was duct tape involved, I think.
Well, and by the way, you know, and I happen to remember, his friend was funny and played off him in a way that I thought was very helpful. You know, because the casting, again, the casting person... You know, and they're sort of asked to do it dryly because they don't want to lead the witness a little bit.
Right.
But I remember watching that and thinking it was to his advantage to have a playful partner. Not that he was on camera.
Yeah.
So I do remember that, yeah.
That's so funny. Yeah, no, I think it was probably another one of his fellow actors on Letterkenny that helped him make the tape.
That's cute. Oh, well, that's cute. That makes sense. He was an actor. I thought he was just a like a pal or something. Yeah, that makes more sense. And he was eating a banana and talking with his mouth full. He was very, very inventive, very funny. Everyone loved him immediately, and that was it.
He's so funny. I can't wait to see.
And everyone loved Thomas immediately. It was just like, are you kidding? I mean, it was just like, can we have him, please? Just stop auditioning people. It was just, he really jumped out of that playing field.
That's so fun. It's going to be so fun to see what all these young actors go off and do. Springing from this series.
Speaking of casting also, my husband's a theater director. And so I would often have my opinions and then show them to Robert, who would see things very often I hadn't seen. And I would say it was actually educational, where he was saying, you know, she's thinking about it, you know, or he was just seeing certain things about how choices were made or how something was internal or not playing externally or too much, or, you know, and that was kind of fun. That you can't do when you're just in a room either. You can't show it to your husband, the director, and say, who would you pick? Yeah. You know? Yeah.
It's so interesting from an actor's standpoint. A lot of the actors, you know, have a strong preference either for the self-tape because they can control it. They can do 20 takes if they want to get
that
it the way
sense.
They want it.
Yeah.
Or for the live in the room audition because they feel like they can make a connection.
Oh, I see.
You know, and yes, they've only got one shot at it, but that human connection thing, it's like, there's nothing like it.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Yeah. I admire actors and could never do that. Oh my gosh, that looks, it's just so, you know, at least like when my work is being considered, I'm not there, you know, a little bit, you know, it's just like, yeah, oh yeah, how'd that go? Yeah, let me know later. You know, there's a step removed and.
Send me an email and tell me,
Yeah, it's pretty brave.
Well, any final comments on screenwriting, on the creative process, on Descendants, anything?
I would just. You know, I think when people, you know, there is a great time in life that you should go after absolutely any biggest dream ever. And then it gets more complicated. And then, you know, and then you can figure out how to sort of blend things together in your life as you get older and have more responsibilities and all that, children and having to support a family and all of those other really important practical things. But I guess I think it's great to really go after the creative life if that's in your heart and that's what you feel is your passion, you know. And I would say, though, that there are lots of ways to skin that cat. And if you don't hit it like Dove has hit it, you know, or Sarah and I hit it, and that's so much luck is involved, you know, that you should just find, you know, that there are great ways of being creative and writing or performing or using that in your life in unexpected ways, and to be open to that.
And to, you can have a creative life, and there are many different forms for
absolutely.
That to take.
Yeah.
And to have access to that joy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love that. Well, everybody look for Descendants 2 on not just Disney Channel.
Right. Now we can say the date. As of today, we wouldn't have been able to say it yesterday.
This is perfect. Okay.
July 21st. Friday night, 8 o'clock Eastern time.
And Pacific time.
And Pacific time, obviously. Yes, right.
8 o'clock.
Pacific time. On every channel known to man. No. if you want to see it with the fewest commercial breaks, watch it on the Disney Channel. But if you don't get the Disney Channel, watch it on ABC or Lifetime.
Yeah. Or Freeform.
Or Disney XD. Yeah.
Crazy. So everybody who wants to follow Josanne, which I recommend, should follow her on Twitter at Josanne McGibbon. That's JOSANNMCGIBBON. And on Instagram, you are Josanne818.
Yes, I will say that will be a little bit of a thankless task. I think I've put up 12 pictures in 3 years. However, I amazingly have like something like 3 or almost 4,000 followers on Instagram because people tag me on all these other Descendants things. And I feel bad because all of these people are probably, you know, following me saying, "What? I get nothing from her."
You're not super active on Instagram.
Not at all.
You're a little more active on Twitter.
Barely.
A little bit.
Barely, yeah.
Still.
So, but anyway, but yes, follow me. Whatever that means.
Well, because, you know, cool pictures and cool things do come out there.
They do, occasionally.
Yeah.
They do.
I've seen some neat stuff there. Josanne, thank you so much.
That was a lot of fun. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Hometown to Hollywood. If you like what you heard here, please subscribe. It's free. Go to my website, hollywoodparentsguide.com, and click on the subscribe button. You'll get weekly podcasts and blog posts delivered right to your inbox that will educate and inspire you. And if you need help figuring out just how to navigate the career of a young actor, buy my book, The Hollywood Parents Guide, on Amazon. Or for one-on-one coaching that can save you literally thousands of dollars and months and years of wasted time, book an hour consultation with me over Skype or in LA. Just go to hollywoodparentsguide.com and click on the consultation page. For the same price of an hour with an acting coach, you can get peace of mind and a detailed action plan. Thanks. Remember, the future belongs to those who believe in their dreams.